civil court.
But it's not a rule of procedure.
It's not? The way things get docketed?
I don't think so.
Why don't we begin our meeting here with call to order. Are there any citizen comments? None? We'll move on then to reports of the chair, and I have none. Are there any committee reports?
Mr. Chairman, I could say that we've made progress on the two resolutions that I mentioned on the zip codes for the Village of Summers. We'll be looking at introducing that in the next cycle after we adjourn Sendai, so we'll post it then and then talk about getting it adopted either later this year or early next year. And that would include the zip code one, which is co-sponsored by Supervisor Bashaw, and the Sheridan Road one, which is co-sponsored by Supervisor Grady. So, and that concludes my report.
Thank you. Anyone else? Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to draw your attention to today's Kenosha News. Timely information here. County offers deed fraud warning. And it's one of these things that may not be particularly on Kenosha County radar, but I think nationally there's a trend towards either misappropriation of deeds or, where more commonly, liens can be placed upon a person's property without their knowledge, and it turns into a whole scenario where they have difficulty with ownership and so forth. So I had a conversation with our Registrar of Deeds today, and that is the good news. There's a plan in place for this. It's been going on for several years. This is not brand new. The issue is the person has to register online either through Google or Yahoo. And I think for probably many people, majority of us, that's not a big deal. That's fine. But in further comments and questioning with our Registrar of Deeds, there's no backup plan. I mean, if the person was not internet savvy, didn't have internet, wasn't capable of doing maybe some of these other things, there really is no fallback plan, and according to my conversation, there is no room for even entertaining that. So this may come back as a resolution, further thoughts for the deliberation. Maybe we can involve other agencies that can help us out with this, but that's just kind of something that's topically prominent, came to day-to-day. Just want to alert you to the fact.
Thank you. The library committee met yesterday, and the town of Randall is considering leaving the associate or the system, and that would upset the whole apple cart. We're grandfathered into this system, and we'd have to completely revamp everything, which might lead to higher costs. So just something to think about. We need to probably get something going and looking at alternatives if that does happen.
All right, thank you. Any other reports or comments? All right, seeing none, the minutes are before you of September 14th. What is your pleasure?
Move approval.
Second.
Second by Aaron. Further discussion or corrections? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Passes. Number six, public works resolution authorizing program on assessments. Who is going to explain that?
It's me.
Oh, Andy, there you are. Okay.
Yeah, hi.
Hello. All right, why don't you fill us in on this and tell us what the proper title of this long resolution title is.
Sure, yeah. So so the county has properties that are tax deeded, and there are some of them that we've come across that are contaminated. And so, or actually, they're tax delinquent. So the county has not taken action on these properties because of the contamination. We don't want to take on the risk. And so they've been sitting for some decades. And so we're trying to take action on two of them, which is the Orange Ooze properties and the Roosevelt Auto Body properties. And what we're looking at doing is having the resolution to allow us to apply for the grants through the state, the DNR, that would give us the ability to be exempt from certain EPA requirements and there are the acronym is CERCLA, which is Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. So we want to be able to claim protection from that liability as a innocent landowner, and to do that, we have to do a phase one on these properties within 180 days of taking them. And then in doing that, then we claim that liability. So we're going for the grant through the DNR. The DNR will do the work. We don't have to do anything. The county doesn't have to pay anything. The DNR has funds that will actually pay for them hiring a phase one consultant to come in and do all the reporting. And then in that way, we then set the property up where we can, where we're free from liability, and we've already had discussions. The county executive has been talking with the mayor to take these properties. To then, there's some agreements on who's going to tear down the buildings and other things depending on the property, so that then the city can work with getting them redeveloped and getting them to be useful tax-paying properties. So this is the first step to be able to do that.
Discussion?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to remember. Didn't we adopt policy at our last meeting to authorize the transfer of the properties? We didn't?
Not on this one.
Different property.
Oh, that was a different, this is a different property.
Mm-hmm. Both of them are different properties.
So do we need to, so we need to get it cleaned up before we could transfer it?
Well,
yeah.
Basically what's happening is the first phase, like Ben said, is the rents available that can be done with any money. There's discussion again with the city where they're going to take it and they're going to be responsible for the help after.
Correct.
You know, but we'll do the first phase at no cost to the county. And then if that works out, you know, the city will take, and there's some kind of talks going on. I'm not going to go into full details, sure. But the city has expressed interest in taking the properties and do the
That'd
full
be great.
Cleanup after that.
Right. You called it orange ooze.
What is this property again?
Say it again.
What is this property that's listed 15th Street, 17th Court?
Some Birch Road and about 17th Avenue, roughly.
Right. Right, off of Birch there, the Ingle Road. There's properties up there. Yeah, there's some on the map, so that's good.
What was that?
Well, it was actually never developed. The right-of-way was dedicated. The subdivision lots were platted. And then, like 25 years ago, when someone went to build a home, they started digging, and that's when they came up with some problems with the property that it was filled. And so it was filled with mainly construction materials, but in the construction materials, there must have been some other hazards, so that when we've done some testing out there already, and that city did a lot of testing out there like 20 years ago, they detected that there were hazardous chemicals in the soils.
Okay. We should do everything we can to accommodate this and get it transferred and get it back on the tax roll. This is a great thing to do. Is there anything else we could do? Or?
No, this is the first step, and then it gets the ball rolling.
All right. And then once we do this, then we can do the transfer, or at least we're in a position to work with the city to do a transfer.
Correct, because now, and we don't have any liability now on anything that's found on the property.
Yeah.
John?
So is the DNR, is it still polluted? Is the DNR going to clean it up, or what's
no,
the status?
No, the cleanup will end up being done through the, most likely the city is kind of what we're thinking, because of the arrangements that are being discussed. But you have to do a phase one, and then you have to do a phase two, and then from that, then you can do the cleanups. And depending on if there's buildings or not, like Roosevelt Auto Body has buildings, you know, then there's a tear down. I think there was some discussions before about Hillside Hardware, kind of very similar process, but we're a little bit ahead on that one, and we were taking a different road until we found out that there was these funds available, and we had discussions with the DNR staff, and they told us that they have funds available, and this is ripe for us to apply for.
Aaron?
So we have to initiate the first phase within 180 80 days? Of, can you clarify that or explain a little bit more?
That's a requirement.
Because it's, so we don't want to take deed the part, we don't want to take the parcels yet until we're all ready and have everything lined up, or?
Yeah, so it says these requirements, I'm reading from them because all this stuff is just so complicated. Is
you mean government language is easy to understand?
Shocking.
Yeah, so some, so in dealing with this all appropriate inquiries rule, there, these, this must be conducted and updated within 1 year before the date of acquisition of the property and other aspects within 180 days before the date of acquisition. So we're looking at doing this 180 days before we do it. And so there is that certain time. They set the rules and we're working within them.
Okay, so we're just waiting until it's the appropriate time to take it and then we'll do whatever they tell us.
Right, because if when once we do the phase
it
one,
the
then we can do the transfer and we can take it in 180 days.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha, okay. I make a motion to approve.
Second.
All right, further discussion? Tim?
You mentioned a phase two. Who will be doing the phase two?
The phase two probably would come, it might, I mean, it's going to be negotiations with the county and the city.
Okay, and what does that involve?
You go ahead.
May I?
Yes.
Okay. Basically, the discussions are we're going to do phase one before we can take over the property. There are some discussions going on also with the city on what's going to happen after that. Pretty much the city's willing to take it and they go through with the cleanup and probably the county will have to do something. You know, it's nothing set, but pretty much it's going to be pretty minimum from expected and the company to do it.
Yeah, so for your answer, like phase one is they do a walk through the property and it's anything that's like observable. Okay. They don't go digging or anything like that. It's anything observable. They look for spots on the ground, things tipped over, barrels of stuff. Phase two is when they go to those spots that they observe. Now they start doing samples. They put probes in the ground, they dig holes, and they take, they then do analysis of what they find and what are the chemicals.
Do we have an idea what that might cost, which we might be?
We nothing, don't.
At this point, there is nothing from the county, and also some things in the city, that would be the city, might be able to obtain grants for the next phase.
That is correct, because I mean, the city has done this many times.
Okay, they can do for the next phase. There is grants that the county, you know, available for the county to get the grants and do the first phase.
Yeah.
And then once it's done, if the deal goes together with the city, then they can apply for funds to do their cleanup.
All I'm saying is this is not set in stone.
And
so we need to be ready to take on whatever responsibility we might have in that phase two. That's so when we agreed to this, because this isn't, there dates that need to be met after phase one is done?
There is no time frame.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The time frame is kind of odd at this beginning.
Okay. All right. That ends my question.
All right. Anything further? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, thank you. We'll circulate the resolution.
Youth and Governance.
Yes. The Youth and Governance voting, or would you like to vote on this?
Aye.
Thank you. All right.
Twisted your heart.
The next resolution you're also going to do for this is the Roosevelt Road Body Shop on 63rd Street.
Correct.
All right, go
same
ahead.
Same steps.
Anything further that you want to talk about on that particular property?
Only that one actually has a building, and so there would be discussions on demolition and so on and so forth.
And that also has stuff in the ground that contaminates?
Right, and basically we know that because there were complaints made in years past, and it's on the list, contamination list with the state. So that's what kind of alerts us that there's anticipation of things there.
All right, discussion.
Well, what would the contamination be from? Do we know?
Just the auto body being there, working with chemicals
okay.
and oils and
okay.
things from the cars.
Gotcha, okay.
just normal things from an auto release.
Anyone else on this? Is anybody own that now, or who owns that?
Well, there are people that own them. They just haven't been paying their taxes.
Delinquent.
Yeah, they're delinquent, but we have not taken them on tax deed yet because there are potential issues.
Move approval.
Second.
All right. Further discussion? Seeing none. All those in favor say aye.
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 You think the governor has voted yes on that too? All right, that's unanimous. We'll circulate the resolution.
Thank you so much. Appreciate
Thank you.
It.
My name's on here. All right, this is number 8, a resolution from Supervisor Thomas to create a risk assessment management practices for Kenosha County. Is Supervisor Thomas here? No. All right, I wanted to give him a first chance to speak on it. All right, who's going to present this?
Well, would he like to be here? We could push it to another meeting.
We could do that.
Motion to defer.
I would second.
Okay.
Till I would say when Supervisor Thomas can attend a meeting, regular board meeting or regular committee meeting.
Sure. He knew about this, right? I assume he did.
Yes, it was referred to us as a board meeting.
Okay. All right. There's a motion to postpone this to another meeting where he can be a president and we'll agenda it at that time. All those in favor say aye.
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 All right. We'll do that. Sheriff, yes. All right, you are Captain
Moranis.
Moranis, yes, thank you. Well, I asked this to be placed on the agenda for some discussion as it was reported at the last meeting. I think you reported that, Barna, that was an area of loss of some $147,000, is my recollection. For the housing of U.S. Marshal inmates. And so I thought you should report to the committee. Is this just a fluke for 1 month that we need not worry about, or is this now a program that was once quite successful but now is gone the way of no longer being a successful or money-making program? I mean, it's made the county in the past a good deal of money. But now we're in a loss situation. Is this something that inflation has just chewed up and defeated the program, and maybe we ought to call it quits? So why don't you get your opinion on some of those things before we lose too much money here on something that is not really essential to Kenosha County at all. We only did it to make money.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I shared with the chair, the contract we have with the marshals was signed by Larry Zaletti in the year 2000, and we get $70 a day for inmates, and that has not increased since the year 2000. So with inflation, every year the average cost a day to house an inmate has gone up, and it's now $120 a day. So we're taking a loss every day that we house a federal inmate. Yeah.
So you're losing every time you get an inmate $50 a day per person.
And our average daily for housing the marshals has gone down every year.
You mean the number?
So the average daily population of a U.S. marshal inmate has gone down. And the end of last year, we actually told the marshals, because of our staffing crisis, we cannot take on more inmates. So we've creeped up back a little bit, but we're still, our average for this year is 40 a day.
And we're losing how much per?
$50
per day.
So
per
head.
We have had increases for the deputy sheriffs that do the transports. We're due for another increase to submit this year. Our intention was, depending on the sheriff, is to ask the marshals that we needed a significant increase or we would not continue on.
So every day you're losing
$2,000 a day.
So 2,000 times
365 is
that's a lot of money.
600 or 700,000.
Yeah, this sounds like something that ought to be terminated promptly.
How long is our contract? Is it we can cancel it any time since it was started in 2000?
I'm sure there's a clause in all of our contracts that there's severability.
Okay. It's not like we re-up it every year or something like that.
No, this has been a standing agreement.
Okay. And is the hopes of the sheriff to get a higher rate, or is his plan, if he does not get a higher rate, that we at least break even, that he is going to sever this?
He hasn't shared exactly
okay.
what his plan would be.
Okay.
I mean, is it likely to go from $170 to $120?
I attended the state jail conference, and there is, so Dane County is ending their cooperation with housing federal inmates, so the Marshal Service had to find two more jails in the central part of the state, and they're doing $93, $95 a day for their inmates, so.
What is their cost?
I'm not sure. On their
okay.
cost,
I was
sure
wondering if
not,
they...
I'm sure it's not as high as like Columbia County compared to Kenosha County, so I know that's one of the counties they're using, so.
Okay.
Interesting. Through the chair to Lieutenant Baranis, when I was the CFO here and we built the detention center and started the housing of the inmates with Sheriff Sarletti, we profited tens of millions. I mean, we netted tens of millions, enough to pay that for that building. So we got a building through federal money. So with that perspective, with a CFO that loved having that I could have a building get paid for, not by the taxpayers here, but by the Fed, I love that. But now, if I were the CFO here today, I wouldn't want it. I wouldn't want this. I wouldn't want to see this kind of a loss. So financially, it is not beneficial to the community here. And that's clear. The auditors say it, the operating department says it, the administration reports that. So it's flipped because of inflation over two decades. Is there any, so financially it's not beneficial, is there any non-financial benefit that we get by doing this?
Not that I can see.
There's no benefit. Is there any action that the sheriff or the administration would like the board to take or we need to take in order to stop this program so that we stop the 2,000 a day loss?
I think it's more of a budget question. So.
Was this discussed during the hearing yesterday?
No.
No, it was not.
No.
Okay. Well, maybe we queue it up for Finance Committee then, when we have our hearing, our budget hearing. So. And we're prepared to address that. If there is no benefit to the community, why keep doing this? So if the sheriff would like to queue that up and would like to help the budget a little bit and not lose $2,000 a day, the committee, I'm sure, would love to hear that. At least I'm one member. I'd love to hear it. I yield. So.
Eric, go ahead.
Why have we been doing it for so long if we're losing money?
I've only been in this position for 10 months. I can say I did bring that up when I was a lieutenant at the detention center when I saw the contract was signed by Larry Zarlady in 2000, and we hadn't had an increase since. So I have asked the U.S. Marshal Service. They said, we'll be glad to help you. There is one person that works the entire country that deals with these kind of contracts, and they said it'll take some time whenever you submit that paperwork. So.
Okay.
Tim?
I think it would be wise to look at the contract and see what it would take to get out of it. Make sure we're not violating something.
Bill?
My question's much the same. If we don't have a rendering on severability of the contract, when can we get a rendering on that from either court counsel or from some other source? How soon can we have info on that?
Jennifer, can you answer that?
Yes, I can. I would need to see the contract.
Okay, do you know?
I've not seen it. I have a copy of it right here.
My guess is 30 days. I can't imagine it being with that kind of rate that it would be less or more. Did everyone get a copy of this?
Is it on the table?
The contract?
Is it on the table?
Captain sent it to me. What's that?
That's okay.
So it ended up only going to Terry.
That's all right. Okay. So the answer is
it went to the lawyer, so that's pretty good.
What does it say? Would you advise us non-lawyers?
$720,000.
Reading it quickly. Yes.
I just have a question. You mentioned that the marshal say it's going to take a long time and do we file the paperwork today? What was that file?
We haven't filed it yet, but they did let me know that there's one person in the U.S. Marshal Service that deals with contracts.
That's ridiculous.
But I will say, I think the marshals need us more than we need them.
Oh, yeah.
Because we do their airlifts, we're like the hub for whenever they do their transports out of this area. We drive them to the Rockford Airport and they go from there.
Do we get reimbursed for that time?
We do.
Okay.
For the transport costs, and then we do get a few more inmates for a few days.
Okay. Tim or Bill?
It would just seem that this whole thing is trending downward, you know, with the red tape involved. You got some type of increase, and just the whole way this has gone, it would seem, unless there's some huge extenuating circumstance, it would be better if you just cut our losses and move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where is this in the budget?
That's
have we budgeted for this loss?
Probably revenue. Huh?
There's a revenue line
it's
item.
It's a revenue item, so that's why.
Mm. So does it show a deficit?
With the expense versus
okay,
revenue?
Okay, well, all right.
So right now we budget for a revenue, I think without having the paperwork in front of me, I think for this year we're at $1.5 million-ish for federal inmate housing.
$1.45 million.
Okay. Now this is the same revenue line item that ICE went into, so I think, Supervisor Gearson, that might be what you're thinking of with that surplus.
Right.
That
it was mainly ICE.
Was from
the,
ICE.
The U.S. Marshal was a lot less.
Yeah. That's one of those line items that we're like slowly trying to get down to be realistic to what we actually receive from the U.S. Marshals, which is usually around 1.2-ish. So that would be the actual revenue that we bring in from them. Not necessarily that that's the profit, but that's the amount that they pay us for it. The expense is obviously broken down by inmate and a lot higher than that. But if we were to remove the program, we would be looking at having to figure out a way to offset that $1.23 million that we do get in from them. However, that is going to be offset in our revenue line, I'm not sure. But that would be something we would have to recoup in some way if we were to drop the program.
Mr. Chair, through the chair to the budget director, did you want to be recognized?
I did.
All right. Well,
so what I'd like to say is that $120 most likely includes variable costs and some sunk costs. So, so when you look at that, if you eliminate the revenue, you're not necessarily eliminating that equal amount of expense potentially.
It's not necessarily dollars.
So that's where the analysis has to come in.
And it's a little bit difficult seeing as the federal population is roughly 45 per day on average, but our entire population is around 650. So we would have to kind of extrapolate how much of those expenses are only related to those 45-ish inmates compared to what's related to the rest of the population.
So would that result in layoffs?
I would really hope not.
not with our staffing levels, no.
I was going to say it would just be
understaffed,
so we just wouldn't need the vacant positions.
Defunding positions. From the research that I've done on it and the cost analysis that I've done on it, I don't see how it would be easy for us to cut the expenses at the same level of the revenue that we would be losing if we dropped the program. So it would not be offset that easily. If we take out the marshals, we're not going to have a decrease of $1.2 million in our expenses. So it wouldn't just be right even and even cut off.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remember this stuff, so it probably is at budget time. We probably should ask for language and not react to cutting the whole thing and cutting the 1.2 million, but ask for language. This is just my thought. to analyze it and bring it back either in mid-year or in a future budget, you know, because there are indirect costs that are blended into the direct costs, and are we absorbing direct costs, which, and then you start getting murky, and start getting fiscally murky from that standpoint. But so, but I do think it's something that really needs to get looked at.
And we don't want to lose a half a million dollars.
Right, I agree. Yeah, I agree.
Studying it.
Yeah.
I mean, this ought to be done this year.
But is it a paper loss or a cash loss? If it's we're not recouping an allocation of overhead that we have anyway, building costs and such, that we have anyway, maybe. So we're just not recouping that, but we still get the cash flow. So to knock out $1 million of revenue, I think mechanically to negatively impacts the budget. So, but I do think it needs to get analyzed, and we need to phase the thing out. I do think that it seems like we need to do that. So.
No.
So can we have that information by our budget hearings as to those 45 prisoners, what the net effect would be when you consider if there was the removal of the $1.5 million in revenue, how much would the net effect be to our budget?
I'm sure I can figure that out.
Okay. That's my question.
Aaron.
Are the costs for our inmates predominantly fixed cost or variable costs? Because that makes a big difference. If most of our costs are fixed, then it doesn't.
Let me look at how I calculate that daily right now. So to break it down by appropriation, we would not be laying people off. We're already short-staffed, so you're not looking at any sort of decrease in your cost for salaries or personnel.
But that's budgeted.
Right.
So that would get decreased because we would defund positions. Or am I wrong on that one?
No.
Losing 45 inmates is not even full. That's about a half a dorm.
Okay. Or a dorm. How many employees is that? A half a dorm.
It's no half a dorm. So whether I have 45 inmates in a dorm or 60 inmates in a dorm, I still have to staff that.
Yeah.
At the same level.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then beyond that, I mean, our contractual costs wouldn't change, so those ones are pretty fixed. We would see probably only a decrease in things like food and kitchen supplies, housekeeping supplies.
Meds?
Medical.
The marshals actually cover their own.
Okay.
So as far as care inside of the facility, that's included in our NAF care contract. We're not charged per person for that. Pharmaceuticals are covered by the U.S. Marshals, and any outside medical care that marshal inmates go to see is also covered by the marshals. So that doesn't hit our expenses. So it would really just be like the housekeeping items. We would really only see a decrease in 46 people worth of food, which wouldn't be very much, and things like toilet paper and other disposables inside the rooms.
There would be savings for deputy sheriff for overtime. So
part
of the issue with the transports is they do not pay for overtime. So a lot of our trips are gone on overtime due to the staffing levels and conveyance. So that'd be another cost. I'm not sure how we've tried to figure that out, but we'll try it again.
Yeah.
So is it our understanding that you will have a recommendation at the budget time?
I can get that from the
sheriff. Okay. Very good.
Here.
Yes.
The contract is pretty straightforward. It's pretty clear bones. That looks to me.
Can you speak louder?
Yeah. The contract looks like it's a 30-day notice for termination. If it becomes undesirable or impractical to house inmates, you need to provide written notice. So it looks like it's a 30-day notice.
All right. John.
Why don't we do the 30-day notice now and then see if they step up and decide to increase our contract?
Good thought. All right.
There's a process in there to how you request an increase in the contract as well. You're supposed to submit a written request asking them. There's a process to request an increase.
If we tell them we don't want them, I think they would advance that very quickly.
Jared?
Yeah.
I'd like to caution the committee before we make jump into decisions mm-hmm. related to this. I believe the budget hearings does not give us enough time to analyze this. There is not a $2,000 a day hard loss for the county. A good chunk of that is a paper loss, expenses that we would incur anyways. It would be my recommendation to give finance enough time to analyze what the true loss is per day, because it could be, the audit showed that this was the first year, and 2022 was the first year it flipped. The reason why it flipped is because there are a number of sunk costs in that calculation. So the true loss could be still a gain. So what I'm saying is, to speak to Supervisor Gertzen's recommendation, was to put language in there that would require us to make an analysis and do that properly, and then come back with a recommendation.
Further discussion?
How about,
where are we leaving this?
Well, how about, do you need direction on asking them to increase their rates, or can you do that?
I have all the instructions.
Okay, and you don't need direction from the board or anything?
I think we have a number.
Okay.
And if they don't.
You have them. You asked for an increase?
Not for okay. the average day for the housing inmates. For the deputy sheriff transport costs, yes.
Okay. Tim?
When can we expect the report?
Okay.
From finance?
Next year.
I would say first quarter next year.
Okay.
I think it would be good to have it before the election, so that all of us here have, we have knowledge of what's going on and try and make that decision with all that background. That would be my recommendation.
So we'll discuss this during the budget time.
I mean, I will say that averaging cost daily per inmate, there's books on that, and it's not easy to calculate. There's all kinds of other factors. Workman's comp claims, legal claims, that large agencies have tried to make it, put it into an average day, and it's not easy. So,
how did Columbia County get 93 and we're still at 70?
Because they asked. And they got it. Yep.
Well, I guess that's the solution.
We just have to ask.
Yeah, got it.
They're sitting, the feds are sitting there going, I can't believe Kenosha County hasn't asked in 20 years. You're getting away with this.
So why don't you ask?
Yes, sir.
So, Mr. Chairman, I do remember that we did file more than one time requesting an increase for both categories and tiers of inmates. So, I think it was U.S. Marshal and ICE, and I do remember this process where we use Maximus and direct costs folded into it, and so we went with the template required by the regulatory agency. So we have done that, and they rejected it. I do remember that happening. It may not have happened in the last 5, 6, 7 years, or 10. I don't know when we did it, but I do remember, and I'm going by memory, having filed more than once requesting for an increase. So
I know when Nancy was still here, it was done.
Right, I yield.
All right, anyone else or any other thoughts, Sean?
No, I was going to say, when you said $120 a day per inmate, we would break even?
That's what we're asking for.
Okay, so that's a break even cost?
Based on the calculations that I did for our cost per day per inmate, but again, like you said, it's a really complicated kind of
right.
formula. So this is really just a basic
okay,
figure
so,
out what it costs.
So even if we were fortunate enough, if we asked them to get $120 per inmate, we're still breaking even.
Right.
We're not making any money.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in an ideal world, they would give us exactly what it costs for us to house the inmates per day. They mm-hmm. would give us the federal rate for mileage, they would pay us per deputy based on the deputy's actual salary, but they just use flat
formula regardless. Yeah.
All right, anyone else?
Sorry.
Okay. All right, yeah. Thank you for coming. Yes, go ahead.
I did want to say about why have we been doing this for so long? these revenue dollars were mixed in with ICE. We only lost ICE in 2020, and I think that is the reason why it's gone so long under the radar of not asking for more, is because we were looking at this fairly comfy honeypot that was ICE. And now that ICE is gone, we're seeing the graveyard that was left over. And now we're realizing that something maybe needs to get adjusted. So it has been on my radar, at least for this whole year, to try and figure out how to ask them of getting an increase in that daily fee and to increase the what they have paid for deputies, because mm-hmm. that amount is still lower than what our lowest paid deputy is.
Bill?
Well, think of it in these terms, just as a conclusion type process. Even if we were to get a daily rate of $120 per day, that's still a break-even cost. We're still chronically understaffed. So what's the end game? What's the point? Why don't we just 86 this thing to the most convenient way we can? I agree upon getting the analysis and support, and just move forward. I mean, it's not in the cards. It's not happening, right? That's my comment.
All right, we'll certainly put this on the discussion agenda when we're at the budget. Thank you. All right, we'll move on then to Brookside, the long-term care report. And Erin has this placed on the agenda, I think, after she read the rather large puppy article in the Kenosha Journal.
All right, so there is a puppy small PowerPoint that I'll pass around. I only have 10 copies, so I hope it
Linda, before you begin, can I recognize that we have the chair of the Board of Trustees here, Chairman Pitts, and the Vice Chair, who's also our County Board Chairman, Noodle. So I just wanted to recognize that.
Thank
you
for doing that. So recognized. Bob wanted to make sure that I shared the best of Kenosha County. Kenosha Brookside Care Center was voted the best, which I'm not surprised because we are. So, good evening, everybody. Yes, as requested in relation to the newspaper article for the transition of 24 long-term care beds from the total of 48 short-term rehab, is hence why we're here this evening. So I just put a couple of statistics. I like numbers. I kind of like to have an idea of what we are looking at towards the future. With these numbers, you can see that we will be caring for an abundance of elderly people for quite some time. And a lot of that is just baby boomers getting older. So I anticipate that will be a very good thing for sustaining Brookside in particular. So the reasonings also in that we decided to transition some of the short-term rehab beds to long-term care is the need. Throughout COVID in particular, we were getting calls continuously about the need for long-term care. People, you know, please take my loved one. Unfortunately, at that time, due to staffing, we couldn't do a lot of that, and our census had not done well. However, things are changing, and we're finding that we're able to do that. There was a multitude of things that led to this decision. The Medicaid reimbursement was a huge game changer. So the state is now actually covering the cost of care for Medicaid recipients, whereas we were losing approximately $147 a resident a day in 2019. They are now actually covering the cost of care that's provided. So that is very large. In addition, short-term rehab has an average length of stay of 14 to 20 days. It is a continual in, out, in, out, in, out. So there might be times, specifically with 48 beds, where there will be days with nobody in that bed because either, everything in healthcare ebbs and flows, particularly with referrals from hospitals. And there might be days that there's nobody in that bed. So at least it can bring some consistency, being long-term care. Also, since COVID, we've noticed the acuity of residents from the hospitals for short-term rehab incredibly high. They are far more costly. It's also consolidated billing, which means we pay for everything. We pay for the pharmacy, we pay for x-rays, we pay for lab. So it's eating into our profits a lot in relation to the short-term rehab. Wounds, the amount of time that it takes to care for somebody with multiple wounds. So that time is the equivalent of money because it just takes more staff. Which leads me to less staff is needed. With the stability of residents, long-term care residents, you just need less staff because those residents are stable. They're there, this is their home. You don't need that high level of acute care RNs that are utilized in our short-term rehab. So that would allow our ratios to be less for CNAs, and we would be using a lot more LPNs versus RNs. Medicare Advantage plans, those are also short-term rehab patients. So that takes a lot of time from staff because of the authorizations that are always needed before they even come there. So if they're in the hospital and there's an authorization for them to come, that's great. Well, in 3 days, we're submitting more paperwork to try to prove that they need more care. So the amount of time that it takes for us to do that is a lot. And that's where we get those shorter lengths of stay in relation to those short-term rehab. Usually they're about 14 to 17 days if we're lucky. I mentioned the increase in the Medicaid reimbursement and overall stability. It's just brings stability amongst the building. There is a short-term rehab, although we do it and we do it well, there is something to say about being able to have the stability of our long-term care residents who love being there. That is their home. That is where that real community of Brookside resides. We have our family members there, and it's just a different feel. And it is one that we want to continue to utilize, especially with those Medicaid increases that has truly helped us a lot. You'll see on the next page our census. Very different than last time we met. Our budgeted census this year is 128. Tomorrow will be at 135. So I did a breakdown of all the different rooms. So the 400 and 700 halls that we currently have today, which are our current all long-term care halls, 74 beds, they're full. Our 100 and 200 halls, which are memory care, we have 32 beds in there. We only have 3 rooms available. Second floor, which is our short-term rehab, 24 beds, all full. We have slated dates for residents. We have planned admissions for every single one of them, every time. So there might be times that we'll only have 3 discharges in 1 week. We've got people slotted in those 3. The first floor, which is the one that we just opened, of those 24, we currently have 8 occupied. So we are working diligently to increase that. We're still wanting to make sure that we have our staffing where it should be, because if we are going to bring any more, we need to increase that staffing. So if we're going to bring in 2 more, we might as well just bring in another 6, because we're going to have to staff that. So we're trying to make that a very smart move, that we might as well just do it all in one bunch. And I am hoping that that will increase again here very shortly. So lots have changed since the last few years, and definitely for the better. All I've wanted since 2020 is normalcy, and I think we're finally getting there. And stability, and kind of back to where we were in 2019. So I'm very excited for Brookside in the future that we have coming our way.
All right, Tim, or Phyllis, who's
here? You touched briefly on staffing, Linda. Just give us a little bit more detail on how you feel your staffing is in the present and the foreseeable future.
So it's been a challenge, I will not lie. Having a industry that requires certifications and licenses, it's not like you can just get somebody from Target to work a register. You know, they actually need to be certified and go through schooling. So it's a very different challenge, kind of like Sheriff's Department. You got to go through training. We have done amazingly well since the increases that were passed by the county board. So again, thank you very much for that. We're still really struggling, I would say, the CNA part of it. And that's just a difficult group. And I've been saying it for a long time. We really have to grow them. And that's what we're doing, is trying to get them specifically through the colleges, if they're in the nursing programs, is to have them have that CNA experience as they are going through nursing school. So it's been more difficult. You know, like every other, you know, you'll have 10 apply. You're lucky if you get two that show up.
So it's the entry-level positions that are the challenge.
Always, right. Yes, for sure.
My question, thank you.
All right, anyone else, Aaron?
Okay, so with the long-term care, we'll need more CNAs.
Yes.
And those are the positions that we have a hard time filling.
Yes.
So what will our shortage be?
Not that much. So we're going to do it gradually. Because if you think of it, we're 24/7, right? So if we were going to add another, say, 6, even 8, for that one particular area, we would need one additional CNA for each shift. And that's not a lot. However, I've got 7 days. So really it's a 1.4 FTE. And just trying to find somebody to do the stability. We've got a lot of kids that are like, oh, I'll do 16 hours a week, or I'll do 24 hours a week. Nobody really commits to 40 hours anymore. It's mesmerizing. So we're piecing those bits together.
Okay. I was around when we were given this.
Absolutely.
The Brookside Care Center Project County Board presentation in November 1st, 2011. You weren't here.
No.
And you mentioned some of these things in your presentation that about the turnover or the roll beds turning over. Mm. Did we not realize that when we presented that this was going to be an issue? Do you know?
I can just speak to what I know in my industry prior to today, that the acuity is incredibly higher today than it was in even 2015.
So it's changed?
Oh, it's completely changed. It's not your hips and knees that it kind of used to be. This is people who are coming in massive amount of comorbidities and wounds. And you know, whether it was a delay of care during the pandemic, I have no idea. But they are sick. They are very sick and so much more complicated to care for.
You said 2015. Is it even worse since 2020, do you think?
Well, 2020 is hard to compare to anything these days because we weren't bringing anybody in.
Well, I mean, prior to 2020 and after COVID, you know, is there a definite difference in...
Between 15 and 20 or...
Before COVID and after COVID.
Right.
It's
different.
It is different.
Very, incredibly. Today is, they're treating hospitals almost like, or nursing homes almost like it's a step down from a hospital. And we don't have physicians on site, whereas it would almost be beneficial to have them, even nurse practitioners, because the people that are coming in oftentimes are either that sick or maybe they were released from the hospital too soon.
And so the advantage or the costs of the outside care, because we're responsible for that, has gone up considerably since COVID or
odds forever.
You know, it's just slowly been going up.
Because I just happened to look through our pharmacy bill today. All those medications that you see on TV is what I'm seeing. And I inquired about that, and they said, one, there's no generic to it yet, obviously, but the medications are so good today that they are treating these certain issues. So it's a good medication to have, but they're so expensive.
Right.
So,
and people are living longer because of it.
Yes.
The patient doesn't pay for that?
No, we do.
For rehab?
For short-term rehab. For short-term rehab. Correct.
Why do we pay it?
Medicare, consolidated billing.
Okay.
Now, upside of the few Medicare Advantage plans, occasionally they might have a carve-out in for their pharmacy, but it's difficult.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have a lot of Medicare Advantage plans that we utilize. I mean, maybe five we'll have as a census, if that.
Okay. And then, so if we are doing less paperwork when we're talking about staffing, does that mean we'll need less people hired to do the administrative work?
Mm-hmm. Probably not. And I say that because, again, we only have five right now.
Okay.
That was because if we had 48 beds, we're going to have even two times that amount, right? It's just the opportunity for the people who currently do it. For example, one of our admissions coordinator, she'll be taking on a financial piece next year that she hadn't done before. So then that can help the finance department. So we're reallocating those responsibilities of like the pre-authorizations. Now she'll be taking on a financial piece that she hadn't before.
Okay. So the long-term rehab or long-term care and short-term rehab have changed drastically since when we approved this in what, 2016, 2017? That we were not anticipating.
And healthcare changes, like,
and it even skyrocketed after 2020.
The Medicaid, the Medicaid is really, again, that was a game changer. So that was nothing that
was
would have been predicted at that point. That was
that's another question.
Huge.
Yeah.
Why did they change the rate, the reimbursement? I'm not complaining. Why did they do that? And how do we know that they're not going to bring it back down?
So Wisconsin was the third worst Medicaid reimbursement in the country.
Okay.
It was horrible. So they're now just paying what's called PDPM, which is patient-driven payment model. And so this is something that Medicare has started as well, and it's just paying for that level of care. So if they're not as difficult to care for, they're a little bit more independent, then we're not going to get as much for them, right? However, if they're really much more care, two-person assist or a Hoyer, you chart for that and you're going to get a higher level. Same with Medicare. So it really all kind of is all over the place. However, it covers what we're doing for them.
So instead of like a flat rate for everyone we used to get, now it's based on what their needs are.
Correct. It definitely is better.
And is it the state of Wisconsin that has increased, or is it the federal? Since you said Wisconsin was one
Medicaid,
of the worst.
So that was the state.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And was that in the budget, or?
It was. We have been fighting for this for over a decade since I've been around. Just saying, just cover the cost of care. That's all we're asking. You're not going to ever make money on Medicaid. But just pay what we're doing for the people. That's it. This is nothing abnormal in the country. We were just one of the last ones to do it.
Okay, and because it's the state, we doubt they're going to be pulling that back.
No.
Okay.
The state of Wisconsin already lost almost 25 nursing homes in the last six years.
Because they were underpaying Medicaid.
That's it. So they realize something's going to have to change.
Especially with the growing...
Absolutely. It's like you can see it, the writing on the wall, and they had to do something.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, Patty.
Tammy, could you tell us how much Medicaid rate went up? Yeah, that
We've seen a couple of 40% hikes. So right now we are averaging about 414 a day. So from we were probably about 260 a day. Yeah, wow. And it keeps changing. So the state's still figuring it out. So CMS, one of the things that's changed since your analysis was the sequestration. They started a 2% sequestration probably 2017, 2016, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And then Medicare used to pay on a RUGS rate. They changed to PDPM about 2020-ish. And then the state now has changed to PDPM a couple years ago. The state is still figuring it out. And but they did have state increases in the rates in the formula. There's a five-piece formula that equates to it. And it is covering the cost of care. But they're still working out those things. We do also receive a supplemental payment, which is a federal portion that covers or was covering the shortfall of Medicaid. So we
as
don't
a
no longer
home.
Need as much. But there's still that availability too. There's 39 million there. The state is thinking we're gonna only need 25 million for all the county run nursing homes. So even if the state changed their rate a little bit and if we lost, we still have more out of that pot we could take. So, but I don't think the state rates are gonna go down.
Okay.
Yeah, just a follow up, how does that relate to federal expansion of Medicaid in Wisconsin? Is that
just, I honestly don't have any idea. I'm not going.
So has it been the state of Wisconsin accepted? No, so that's a separate issue.
Yeah, and I don't know how any of it would impact anything.
Well, Medicaid is not just nursing homes, though.
Right,
so.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, I was just thinking that one. I had not heard about this expansion. It's great. I mean, it's good news.
Yeah. Oh, it needed to happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Dave?
I don't know if I'm getting ahead of the report. This report shows we're in the black, $283,000.
So that report that you received is what you requested at the Human Services Committee for our savings on the Unidyne.
Oh, the Unidyne.
So the Unidyne change, that shows the original, what we submitted.
Oh, Unidyne.
Yeah. I tried to label it good.
Got old eyes. So.
Yeah. So that's showing how much we've saved from cutting their budget. So that gives you the original, what we had in the proposed budget, the cut that was made, and then what the adopted budget was. If where they're running at year to date through August, if we had straight lined what they needed, where we would be, and then how much we've saved so far. So the things that when we cut, what we did was we defunded positions and we closed down kitchens. So they had like a neighborhood kitchen on each hall. So they were able to work within that budget. So
is this a real loss that goes to the bottom line, or is it just not real because the census is down? But actually the census is up quite a bit.
Well, so. It is now.
So it's a real cash saving.
If they were funding everybody and if we had all the kitchens open, we would not see that savings. And I think we still have one kitchen
we
closed.
Do.
One, yep. We still have one kitchen closed, so.
So we're saving almost 300,000, which is what we thought we would save when we approved this in the last Human Services budget hearing a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Good. All right. I yield. I have another question later, but you can address that later.
All right. Any other discussion?
I just wanted to kind of draw some parallels for you right now. So we had a presentation from the Sheriff's Department, and we talked about dollar for dollar, the decrease in the revenue wasn't going to be a decrease in expense. We have the opposite here. It's that Medicaid, we can't make money, but we have fixed costs that can be spread across that increased census that brings more money into the facility that offsets expenses that we have. So we're not making money, but it keeps us from losing money. So it's kind of the same thing, only backwards, but that's one of the reasons this model works. The other thing that I wanted to point out is, obviously, for a couple years, we've been talking about Brookside, you know, census and staffing and everything else, but one of the ideas that we talked about was potentially turning the two-story rehab into assisted living. Mm-hmm. Assisted living is a set, no, you know, there's no Medicare involved, things like that. Willowbrook is always at capacity or pretty close, waiting lists. But that would have involved construction. It would have involved, because there has to be a separation, and it also would have required us to decertify some of the beds. And once you've decertified, you cannot get them back. This model gives us that flexibility that if for some reason rehab becomes all the rage and that's the moneymaker, and Brookside decides by attrition to then fill those rooms with rehab patients, they have that ability.
We can flip back. Yeah.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the last report I saw, I can't remember, we did get a report on Brookside, the most recent report, I can't remember, I think it went through August, maybe it was July, but it showed that our deficit was below a million, but between half a million to a million, right? Mm-hmm. So now at this 134, is that updated? I mean, do you have an estimate now?
We don't have an estimate for the 134 because it's, we've only hit it one day, so I don't know what the revenue is based off of that yet. However, because of the Medicaid, the ups and downs with the Medicaid, the supplemental payment has not been stable. The rates, they're still ironing out. Right now we've got a rate that's overinflated because they're giving us the rate without any Medicaid cost report adjustments. So we're getting a good rate, but I'm reducing it $10 a day to adjust because I know eventually we're going to hit.
They'll clawed back.
Yeah, so we have a little buffer in there. However, when I've done my analysis for August, taking, and the other thing is July 1st is when the state starts their budget, so we received a retro payment for July portion. So August was a loss, but when I put everything back to the buckets where they needed to go, August actually made $60,000. So, and we were at an average of, I think, 120.2 for that month. So I know that's continuing to go up. So I think that 60,000 is conservative, but I think when we're getting into the 130s, that's only going to get better because, yeah, when Sheriff was talking, I just was wanted to talk because I am seeing our rate per day, our cost per resident day is very high, but it's because we're not filling beds. And as long as your costs are covering your variable costs, then whatever's over that, you're covering a portion of the fixed cost with that. Mm-hmm. That is, you're going to have regardless. So so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to fill these beds and have that stability because the long-term census as well is like a 600 to 700. Our software doesn't go back that many days, but their average day is 600 to 700 days. So we're talking years, and it's probably even longer. It's just that we have a new system that doesn't calculate all the way back. So when we hit COVID, we're not gonna have these decreases because it's not short term. It's gonna be people that are there, and they're there for years. So we're not gonna see those changes. So
thank you very much. That answered my question. So here's where I'm going with this. We have budget hearings coming up. This probably more relates to finance, what we would discuss in finance. And I know we've got the analysis on the ARPA. And my recall is that we had set aside $1 million to cover a deficit at Brookside. And the money has to be, pardon me?
1.27.
Yeah, thank you, Patty, over $1 million. So, and my other the other thing I'm remembering is we have to spend this money in 2024. But maybe they're going to give us a cushion. I don't know that. But if we, so what I'm thinking is that at a minimum we put language in the budget that allows us to do something that possibly could reduce taxes. Maybe we could use it to offset the bonding, or you could bring a plan in during our budget. And it wouldn't be something that we would adopt hard. We would wait to see how we are, but then a plan to
use ARPA, and I obviously like to see it reduce taxes, but maybe other people have other ideas for it. But, and I'm not talking about reducing the levy. I'm talking about possibly reducing debt service or something else that prospectively reduces taxes. So, but and that would just be language that we would consider now that you know we've got one. And of course, if it's just language, it could revert back to covering Brookside or whatever else it's needed for. But we can contemplate in that in the budget. So that's where I was going with this.
One of the things to keep in mind with the ARPA funds is they do need to be expended by the end of 24 or obligated. And discussions that I've, webinars and discussions I've sat in at federal level have been that although there isn't a very clear definition of obligation, even after all this time, if it is in the budget, it is obligated. We don't budget for 2 years, so if it's obligated, it needs to be expended by the end of 26. But in our case, if we had it in a 25 budget, it would be obligated before 26. So we could use some of those ARPA funds towards the 25 budget.
So, what, and we could do that. The other thing we could do is, let's say we got $1.5 million of ARPA money, and we're going to borrow $20 million, $19.5 million, we legitimately could use that $1.5 million, and we feel it would be prudent. That we wouldn't be taking an unnecessary risk. It would be prudent to do that. Well, then instead of borrowing $19.5 million, we borrow $1.5 million less, and then reducing the debt service going into 2025. I mean, that's what's going through my mind that might help us with cut the tax cutting idea. So I yield.
All right, any other discussion on this? All right, thank you for coming and
absolutely
for seeing you. Thank you.
In a couple weeks.
All right. Number 12 is the presentation of the single audit. I'm sorry. Yes. Our tax deed appraisal report.
$1 million worth of property.
Okay. So, we went. I think most of you probably remember the discussion we had last time around. I took those 10 properties and did hire for an appraisal. And you all got copies of the actual appraisals, and then I kind of just put them together here on this page to show where we're looking at, where the appraisals came in comparison to what the last assessment was on the property and what the fair market value was. And we were trying to determine a solid place to start the bids. Some of these I feel like, you know, my experience with tax deed is we just really want to sell them. We are not going to make any money off of these. So I'm a little disappointed at some of the results on here, but my suggestion is that unless you think something different, would be to give this a trial of where this appraised, you know, we paid for the appraisal, let's see where the market stands. And then I would also like to have something set up in advance for the properties that maybe don't sell at auction. And can we set like an across the board mark, you know, reduce it by 10%. And so I don't have to keep coming back to you guys every single time we need to change the price. I think once we get through this initial auction, it'll give us a good idea of the things that we need to look at. Almost all of these houses require repair, but an appraisal is done based on the comparatives around it, and not so much some of the conditions we're taking into consideration, but to get the appraisal
This, it was basically an abbreviated appraisal. They did not, he did not go into the homes. He did go to the homes and go around them, but he did not go into them.
They call it a drive-by?
Well, maybe. I mean, it's a restricted, I think he called it a restricted,
restricted.
Appraisal. And so, but anyways, most of these properties are 5 years or more delinquent. By time we get through the whole process of getting them and getting them ready for sale. And with that delinquency, there's generally no care, and even before those 5 years of delinquency. So we know these properties are in poor shape. So my intention is to have put these up for auction on November 1st and go from there. So I don't know what else more to say, what your thoughts
right, thank
are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we, so if I understand right, you'd like us to use the appraisal column?
Well, that was the idea of getting the appraisal to begin with.
You're advising the committee you would like us to start at the appraisal column.
I would like to try it with this to
and
see where we're at.
You'd like a 10% latitude downwards if that first track doesn't work? Is that
right.
what you're requesting?
That is correct.
I think we need to make a motion on that. So I'd make that motion.
All right.
I would make that motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion? You're done, Dave?
I'm done. Yeah. I'll
Aaron?
Defer to
do you think spirit. These homes, based on, you probably have seen the inside, do you think that they will go for the appraisal amounts, but because they did not go in, the appraiser did not go inside, you think these are still high?
Some of them I think are still high.
Okay.
Like the one that is $45,000.
Okay.
That one needs all new. And he did go there, but he didn't go in. The whole place is boarded up. It's evident that there's creatures probably living in it.
pictures, you can see the whole.
And this one is the piece of property that has that 15-foot egress that's on the deed to the next property that they're allowed to use that 15 feet to drive back to this house. It's a very, very small lot. Ideally, the city would be like, we'll take it and we'll raise it. But they can only do so much too, I guess. You don't really want to see it sell for too cheap. Someone fix it up just enough to make it livable, and now you got a a bad place again. So you can't see this from the road, and this is right over by the Boys and Girls Club. So it's I think that one's a little high.
Okay.
But I'm looking at, when I look at like the assessment and the appraisal, some of them seem good. These ones that have order to repair, they all need repair. These just happen to have written orders from the city already. So I would say that like I said, my history with doing tax deed auctions has been, we sell them, we start them out low, they bid them up, and we want to get back, we wanted to get back at least what the county was owed, and previously we were able to keep anything that was left, and it's not really working, it won't work that way this time. Some of this money we may in 5 years still have, because we can't find the people to send them the money, but I don't know what else.
No, that's fine. I'm just wondering, based on your experience, because we can't make any money on these.
Right.
So is it worth having these not sell, do the work to reduce the price, and then put it out for bid again, when it's our, it's costing us, which we're able to reimburse ourselves, yeah. But still, it's still time when we don't make any money on
it. So I totally understand what you're saying with that, but what we're looking to do after talking with Corporation Counsel is protecting the county on the changes in this law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
And so if we document, this is where it came from, mm-hmm. this is what it said it was appraised at, and then nobody bid on it, because they have to bid at least the opening bid. They can't bid less, and then we lower it down. And then we have documentation that we have attempted to sell it at what...
We made a good faith effort.
Yes. Okay. And in the long term, the whole idea behind that process, even though it costs the county, we should be able to get that money back because it's costing us to make the sale or to prepare the property for sale. But my concern has been the little bit that it might cost us could save us a lot in the long run through court cases, because there are court cases going on.
Penny.
I just to remind everyone, that new law says that the owner of the property can come back and say, I want the difference, and they can argue that we didn't sell it for fair value. Mm-hmm. So this gives us a basis.
Okay.
I understand it's more work.
It's more work for us.
I trust
Reggie.
But we can charge for that anyway.
But she's right. We start here. If you give her blanket authority of reducing 10% on those that didn't sell, we do have that history. And if that owner comes back and says, but you only sold it for, we can say, we had an appraisal done. That is the fair value we went on. Did not sell. We reduced it by this. Still did not sell. Reduced it for this. We would have very good grounds to say that we did our due diligence to try to get the fair value for that property.
So this is a good process.
Yes.
Okay.
It may be painstaking. Kind of.
All right, Tim, and then Bill.
So do we need to put that in the motion that it goes down 10% every time that it doesn't sell?
Did you just ask for the first 10, or did you want to go multiple 10?
A multiple. I mean, I wouldn't want to go beneath what we're owed. I would come back to you.
So that was my intent, that we would go just the way you said.
Yeah, so I could continue.
The initial appraisal, multiple 10s, not below our cost.
Right, not below what they owe.
And so that's your motion?
That was my intent.
Can I just...
Who seconded
it? I did.
Okay. I just wanted to ask
discussion.
A question.
All
right, did you say that there's like a 5-year window where they can come back and claim the amount of a profit above and beyond what they owe for the sale? The original owner, the delinquent owner, something?
I don't believe it's 5 years. Usually with tax deed, the language in there was 3 years. Is it five?
With the new law,
So after 5 years, that the delinquent homeowner doesn't have any claim on the amount above and beyond what they owed to this county?
I would like to tell you yes, but I can tell you that everything I've watched and read on this has said there's no case law on this. Some things just don't make sense. And in 5 years, I think I will know that answer.
I'll ask the question in 5 years.
Thank you.
I guess what I'm saying is, say we, take the one at the bottom. We sell it for $292,
mm-hmm.
and we're only owed, well, by time you add in some of the more mm-hmm. new, say we're owed $60,000,
mm-hmm.
and so there's $232,000. We send that to, if it's a profit part, we would send that to the previous owner of record.
Oh, you'd have to send it to him or her.
Without asking them. They do not have to ask.
That's right. They don't have to ask.
It used to be that they did, but they do not. So, but if that gets returned to us, that money goes and sits, and then we hold on to it. It's my understanding we don't have to try to hunt these people down.
Okay, let me get one second thing straight. So you would have to, we'd have to send it to them, the profit.
Automatically.
So why wouldn't they take it then?
Well, if we can't find it.
Oh, so you're saying if they just disappear and you can't find them?
So when we first took the properties, they all received letters from myself and the county treasurer joined saying, please update your address with us. You are, you know, possibly could get profit from the sale or proceeds from the sale. And we actually, out of all, there was like 40 letters we sent out.
Mm-hmm.
I think I got 3 letters back.
Wow.
Okay. And I, when I say back, not just returned, like, because there, a lot of these people weren't even evicted yet. So it was during the eviction process that that letter went out.
So they don't read their mail.
Right. Right. But or
very carefully.
Yeah, and I'm saying it didn't necessarily come back as undeliverable or, you know, vacant or anything.
They just
like
didn't
that.
Respond.
They just didn't respond.
That's staggering.
So that means does that mean when that check, when you're mailing that check, because they did not respond, you're mailing it to the address you have on file.
Yes.
Which they probably don't live at anymore because it's no longer their house.
But it's a lot of record keeping.
And you don't need, but then you don't need to follow up on it. You send one check, they don't respond, and
Patty
then
5
years
know,
later.
Patty might know better than I do about
I don't know how much work you, like you said, I was also under the impression we tried, but we don't have to like hire a detective to find them.
Okay.
But Tammy just looked up the statute language, and that's where the 5 years comes in.
Okay.
If we try to pay them and we cannot find them, then that's where the clock starts on the 5 years.
Mm.
We still have to hold on to it because they have the right within that 5 years then to say, oh, wait, you sold that property. I heard I can get some money out of this, and then we would work with them. But after that 5-year period, it doesn't
matter. They
makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's why, so that's why trying to, it kind of has taken us this long to get to this point with this group of, I mean, I have more properties, but with this group of in-rem properties, and to try to interpret what the law is saying and what the proper procedure will be for it. But as soon as we sell these, we want to get the checks out right away to start that 5-year time. And then I will be, I'll have more, but I have a lot more, and then we're going to be doing another in-rem process before the end of the year. So, but I want to see how this goes, and if this looks like it works for, good, like you said, good faith that we are doing, yes.
Bill.
So let's just go through the proposition of the protocol here. Your proposition is to begin November 1st.
With these 10.
These 10, advertising them at the boldface value. That would be the minimum required opening bid, correct?
Correct.
Okay. How is this done? Is this done by sealed?
Sealed bid.
And the length of time that they would have to bid upon these properties would be how long?
Well, they could bid all the way up until November 1st. There'll be a time deadline.
Well, you're starting November 1st.
No, I will have the auction November 1st, meaning that's when we're going to open the bids.
Okay, so you
advertise I have everything pretty much ready. So as soon as after tonight, we'll get the publication in the newspaper, and we have an email list that goes out to all the interested parties, and we put on the website, it's in the newspaper, and we can collect bids, sealed bids, all the way up until November 1st.
Okay.
And they only have like 10 days to pay, and that's been typical. I'm not changing that.
In full.
Okay.
So if I understand, you do this immediately. It's approximately a 2-week bid process. Then they have 2 weeks basically to submit their bid. If not successful, then what is the backup plan? It's to be reduced 10%. We've already decided that. What would the time frame be done?
Well, depending upon how much ideally would be to get another auction up and going to where basically we would be having some regular auctions to keep these properties moving.
So, I mean, can you give us more of a framework?
It probably wouldn't be until December until there would be another one. I'm going to be out for 2 weeks and have surgery.
And then your proposal would be the same length of bid Time, approximately 2 weeks.
And hopefully add other properties to it. And not just the leftovers of this, but I'll hopefully...
How many are we talking about? 50 or so properties?
Right now, yeah, probably. There's few that were hanging over that we've had and had to have some work done and had like cleanup and raising and things like that, and those properties need to get brought forward
So if I understand the protocol to carry on then, for those new properties that are added to the new auction, the protocol would be the same. We'd be accepting the appraisal report. We'd be informed of it. The committee would receive copies of what new inventory is being added to the...
Yeah.
And we proceed along that way. I think I could go along with that. That satisfies my question. I yield the floor.
All right. Are we ready to vote on the resolution? All right. Why don't we do that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Right. Anything else? I thought they did.
Terry's got really good hearing.
just so you're, until we get this process really laid out, I will be having to come forward with the appraisals and get that.
Right.
But, you know, hopefully maybe since this will be an ongoing thing, maybe it would be something that a report you would just receive, and if, you know, and I come to the meeting, if you have issues, then we discuss the issues.
I think the most salient part, because you already have this from the past, would be the new properties to enter in that were brought up to date and were apprised of those. That would be my request, that we're making sure we're abreast of those changes. Yeah.
And the ones that didn't sell.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I just don't want to have to wait to bring, like, sure. I can inform the committee the report of the sale, how the sale goes. And
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, next item is the single audit.
Are you doing that?
I'm doing that.
All right.
You have before you the single audit, which, as you can see, is much, much thinner than the financial audit you received last month. The single audit is a component of the audit that audits our federal and state grants. Some municipalities do not receive much in grants. The threshold is $750,000. The county receives more than $750,000. We've been having single audits for as long as I have been here, and Dave can talk back to the beginning of time.
I remember started it. Created it.
So I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time on this. As you, if you walk through the report, you'll see the auditor's report, things that they look at when they're doing a single audit. When you get to page 4, it begins a list of our federal grants. And as I said, there are quite a few, and they have certain thresholds of which they have to identify grants that are considered major, and they do certain procedures on those. On page 9, you can see the total of our federal grants, which was $37 million, slightly over $37 million.
$750,000.
Yeah, a little bit higher. And then beginning on page 10 are our state grants, and those continue on to page 14. State grants total 23.3, and the total of the two, although it doesn't show the total of the two, the total of the two is $60 million. Moving on, then there are footnotes. Some are just pretty standard, the basis of presentation. There's a little bit of detail that's shown in here as well. That's the next few pages. And then they have the schedule of findings and question costs. That's on page 18. You can see that there are no findings in the 2022 audit. It is an unmodified opinion, which is good. And then there's a little bit more detail that they show as you move through the next couple pages. And then the last piece of paper talks about the fact that there was a finding last year and that it was rectified during 2022, and there were no findings noted in the 2022 audit.
So what was it last year?
The issue last year was not a compliance issue. It wasn't that we used any of the funds incorrectly. It was a reporting issue. There were three instances in which there was not a second level, a documented second level of review on reporting that was done to draw down grants. One was in human services. The second level of review had been done, but it was not documented. One was with a Brookside grant that there was a turnover in staffing, and it was believed that it had been done. They were told it had been done, and then found out it had not. So it was, the report was then filed timely, but the focus was on getting the report filed timely, and the second level of review was not a consideration at the time. And the third was, again, not documented, and that was with the major ARPA funds we had received. The report was filed. There was discussion between me and Barna on the filing of the report, but he had not signed off to say he had reviewed it. So we have spoken with all of our fiscal staff, gone through our procedures more carefully, reminded them all that a second level of review is needed. All of that has been done, and as you can see by the letter in there, they looked for that again this year to make sure that we were no longer, that we had no issues with that and it was all fine. Okay. Any questions?
No findings is great.
Yeah.
Better.
All right, then we'll move on here. Are there any reports? Number 14.
I'd just like to make a comment. Good evening.
Yeah.
On the exit survey results, this is the first time that we have seen that pay has not been reported in the top three reasons for separation. So this is our first survey result since Class and Comp. So I just wanted to thank you all for helping to make that happen.
So what length of time are we talking about since the previous exit interviews?
This was for the third quarter.
For the third quarter.
Yeah. And the Class and Comp went in on July 2nd. Okay.
What was the primary reason for exit?
Actually, this time around it was retirement.
I saw the dashboard. Does it compare us to other peers? Like, how are we doing comparably?
We are not comparing it to peers right now.
Because I saw one at zero. And you could go up. Get to 100 and down to 100, I can't. And then one at minus 10 from the zero. And I was, and then there was the other ones in the dashboard, and I was just wondering how we compared to our peers. It was that, is this good compared to our peers? It seems like comparing to the peer is the way you would know how you're doing. Maybe not.
Yeah, and I can talk with Kelsey Hubler, is the one that puts this together for us. Those barometers at the bottom, the net promoter scores, right? So that's a market research type of tool. We would need to have peers utilizing a similar tool, I think, to compare. But I can talk with her about that. Those numbers aren't the best that we've seen, but we are getting good results in the other sections.
Bill.
Just a general type question, Clara. I know in private circumstances, private employers, oftentimes the person will retire just due to, you know, so many years of service. They don't want the responsibility of their day-to-day grind, but they still would like to be active and so forth. And sometimes the entity will hire them back as a consultant on a part-time basis based upon their expertise, and they don't want to see all that, you know, training and information go away. Does that happen to any extent with us here in the county? Or we ever?
Well, we do bring retirees back to work part-time.
Okay.
That's certainly not unheard of, and we like to take advantage of that. So folks will retire because they don't want that, you know, 40-hour-a-week day-to-day grind. But certainly after they've, you know, retired for a bit and decide, hey, maybe I could spend a few hours of my week doing something, if we have an opportunity, we've brought some back to do either same job they've done or in other capacities.
So is that evenly spread across the employment spectrum in Kenosha County? Does it tend to go one way more than the other in terms of departments and that type of thing? Can you elaborate?
Sheriff's Department, okay. Conveyance, the trip officers, sometimes come back. We have administrative staff that will come in and fill in on a temporary basis for clerical support or, you know, it varies.
Well,
but when we have someone, say, on a longer term leave and we need to find temporary, that's a great opportunity for us.
It's my question, Mr. Chairman.
Hey.
Bailiffs are another area where correctional, or not correctional, but sworn might come back and be bailiffs. They tend to do that. One of the things I will let everyone know is when we have, they're called rehired annuitants. They are county employees. They're not contracted. But as a rehired annuitant, they are drawing their pension from WRS. And we have to make sure that they don't go over $1,200. That is the rule, because if they go over $1,200, they would have to forfeit their pension because they're working too much. So we do an analysis of that with every payroll from the time they come back to work for us. But we have other things we're analyzing it just as a piece of the pie.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other reports?
I have our general fund year-end forecast updated through September. So in the box, you can see in the bottom there that it deteriorated a few hundred thousand from last month. I'll go through the pieces that drove that. Our treasurer revenue surplus keeps chugging along at a good rate, and that'll keep working upwards. Our workers' comp insurance surplus improved, lower claims is the reason for that. Our human services surplus dropped down, and realistically it's probably in the low negatives, but I like to smooth out the large drops. We had an uptick in placements and dads. The other ones are not really significant. The city of Kenosha TID closing proceeds were based on an estimate of $200,000. We actually got $104,000. Our liability insurance flipped from a deficit to a surplus, so that was good. On the lower section, on the items causing decreases, Sheriff's Department decreased a couple hundred thousand more. The usual suspects, we have overtime in the jail, inmate medical, pharmaceuticals, and then some variable costs, food.
What we were talking about this evening, is that a deficit?
That potentially, the revenues are in the second line there. That certainly is the federal inmate housing revenue, and also the HUBER reimbursement. So that comprises
the revenue. So it was 147 last month, so what is it this month?
I'm sorry, what?
I thought last month we said, you said that it was $147,000 deficit.
That was the audit, right?
Yeah, that was the audit for the entire year for 2022.
Okay, how does that compare now?
We did not do that analysis for this year yet, but that would be with all the costs in March or April, which is another reason why I track this.
Say Q1.
To do that analysis when we have all the costs and everything in. Okay. That's the sales tax, we're still below budget. We're still practically even with last year's record, but we're still trending below budget. I'm still holding out hope that we'll take an uptick in the last 4 or 5 months here. Or 4 months, I should say. Christmas, spend a lot of money for Christmas. That's the main material items. But overall, we're still, when you look at the overall scheme of things, anything within $1 million, one way or the other, we're still at break even at this point. as the months go on, we'll get more sharper into focus on where we'll be. That concludes my report. I'll take any questions.
All right. Discussion? All right. No more reports? Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And you'll send out the schedule of the meeting.
I can't hear him.